I wanted to start off today by talking about a scene from Greg Egan's novel, Permutation City. And Egan imagines a scenario that I've been resisting for at least 3 years, namely that we can download human consciousness into a computer. Although I must say he does it in a remarkably intelligent and interesting way. And in this scene, a character, Thomas Riemann, has died in the flesh and now exists only as a simulation or copy inside the computer. He was a big industry person, and so he decides to model his interface with the computer as a boardroom, because that's the setting in which he was very familiar when he lived in the flesh and was the director of a large international corporation. And he thinks to himself that this metaphor is somehow more honest than others that he might have chosen, as well as familiar and comfortable. So we start off with this idea of the interface as a metaphor, but then gradually as the narrative progresses, he comes to realize that his body is, of course, also a metaphor, since he's now actually a software program and not a corporeal person. And then Egan, following this line of thought, has his characters gradually also realize that time and space in this setting are also metaphors, since they live as memory pieces distributed in widely different addresses in memory until they're called up and processed. So there's really no need to imagine that they live in continuous space and time, other than as metaphors that make them feel comfortable and familiar. So this kind of startling realization sets the scene, I hope, for my discussion about the importance of metaphors. And I'll just make a comment that I also made yesterday as a way of distinguishing between interface, about which a lot of people have talked, and metaphors, which have also been a consistent thread in our discussions. Whereas the interface transfers information from one format or medium to another, metaphors have the particular property of moving meaning from one word to another. The definition of metaphor, as you know, is a specifically verbal one. That is, it's a transfer of meaning from one word to another word. It comes from a Latin root meaning to transfer or to carry. And by inventing the term material metaphor, what I mean to suggest is that the traffic now goes not between one verbal construct and another, but between a material artifact and a verbal construct. And that's perhaps summarized here in this delightful slide that was loaned to me by my colleague Paul Sheets, which he took in Greece, where this delivery van is actually called Metaphoris, recovering for us the actual root of metaphoris, to transfer or to bear. And so I'll be talking about the artifacts that function as material metaphors as delivery vehicles. And then just to remind us about some of the properties of metaphors, and here I'm not interested in distinguishing between metaphors and similes and similar verbal tropes, so I'll just for convenience call them all metaphors. There are basically two different kinds of metaphoric structures, where one word can branch into two meanings, as in tree, which could mean either plant, or in a computer context, a decision tree, or where two words conflate and come together in one meaning, as in love is a red rose. And then, moreover, I'd like to remind us that metaphors, to be good metaphors and effective metaphors, always require operation across some kind of differential. If you said, for example, love is like a transcendental experience, it wouldn't be a very good metaphor, because both of those are very vague and abstract. So the differential can be from the abstract to the concrete, from the embodied to the social, and the kind of metaphors that Lakoff and Johnson talk about, from the unfamiliar to the familiar, Adam is like a golf ball, or from the familiar to the defamiliarized. And this is by no means an exhaustive list, but I'm just drawing it to our attention bring up that question of differentials. physical artifacts can act as delivery vehicles and therefore as metaphors. They have specific material properties, and these properties can be mobilized as resources for metaphoric transfer of meaning across differentials. So these physical properties, in fact, provide networks of associations, much like words provide network of associations that can be mobilized for meaning transfer. And to make this more specific, I'd like to discuss, as my first example, Ann Tyler's artist book, Love Dub, and I'll be just passing that around for you folks to look at. These are some other instances, but practically you could list almost any artist book and make many of these same points. In Tyler's Love Dub, she explores the significance of an incident that happened a couple of years ago. Some of you may remember when Jenny Jones on her TV show invited a man who was told that he had a secret admirer. Two people were on stage who came on stage as his potential secret admirers, and it turns out his secret admirer was the man and not the woman. And as a result of that, and also a few events that took place off stage, he purchased a 12-gauge shotgun, went to the home of the man who'd been identified as secret admirer, and shot him in the heart. So Tyler takes this very dramatic and tragic incident and builds her artist book around it, primarily through two principal metaphors, the book as a body and the book as a performance. And so some of the sheets of the book, like the image you see here, are very graphic, anatomical details of interior parts of the body. And penetrating all the pages of the book are die-cut holes, which, as this image makes clear, in one context stand for the hole that was shot through the man's heart. And as Tyler recalls this episode for us, she points out that the audience was let in on the so-called secret before the man was told who his secret admirer is. And so another aspect of the book as performance is to position the reader as part of a voyeuristic audience, which is also participating in the secret at the expense and discomfiture of the of Jonathan, the man who then performed the murder. And so part of the pages cannot be opened, so you are forced to peek through them as you do here. But there's also a play here between the anatomical specificity of the image of the heart and then these cheesy little candy Valentine hearts with messages on them. So it's drawing to our attention and putting into play the difference between the physicality of the book, the physicality of the actual body, and the social constructions that surrounded and energized the tragic train of circumstances. In one portion of the book, we're given pages which fold out through successive images. Part of these foldouts are arranged so that a man's face appears, but underneath that's another man's face, so you can form a kind of hybrid image from the two halves of different men's faces. And you'll see there's a small cutout there, and underneath the cutout you can see the man's skin, but a still deeper cutout reveals the tissue underneath that. So there's a constant play between surface and depth throughout the book, and this correlates in some way with the physical reality of the body that will be rendered a piece of meat versus the social constructions that play over the surface of the text and over the surface of the TV screen. So the book is also a performance in the sense of recontextualizing and re-embodying something that happened in another medium, namely the TV show, but now in the context of this book, which does a much deeper exploration of its meaning. So at the bottom of this particular series of cutouts, there's, "Oh no, she's not your secret admirer. Tee hee" is on the last sheet. And that that verbal play between tee hee as a kind of titillating secret that the audience is in on, and he is the masculine pronoun merge as homophones within this context. Many of the pages are translucent sheets, and these translucent sheets, which allow you to see images and words on the sheets, but also what's underneath those sheets, generally have four components: the narrative, which is telling the sequence of events that resulted in the murder, the definition of technical medical terms, and all of these technical medical terms are about a body in crisis and deep distress, and then a timeline of the narrative. So the anatomical tissue often serves as a background image for the verbal content that's on these pages, so that at the same time that you see these words, like what the technical medical term for stop breathing, for example, technical medical term for not being able to breathe in a horizontal position, and so forth, you're made aware of the living body as process. And that's implicitly contrasted with the durable, inert descriptions. So at one point, she brings into play the possibility that the inscription is also a process. Through this sheet, which has those pullouts, and as you pull the sheet out, then you can read different words in the different cutout positions. And as the text itself becomes a process, a text that's movable, can generate different meanings, underlying that is the realization that the living body itself, as we get these medical terms of distress, is moving through the point when it will not be able to sustain process and also become inert, dead material. And then I mentioned the die-cut holes that go through the text. And at the final page of the book, we get all the die-cut pieces that were cut out to make these holes collected in an envelope without any commentary. And it seems to provide the suggestion that there is a residue when the when the doctor performed an autopsy on the dead body. He found the body had been shot at such close range that there was actually wadding from the shotgun shell found inside the heart. And so in the same way, the residue of what's been cut out appears at the back of the book. And it's kind of a residue in the book's body that's analogous to the residue that was found in the actual physical body. And it invites us to meditate on what the kind of social residue and ethical residue is of the performance that's been enacted in the book, and particularly in our positionality in that as a voyeur. And then, of course, it also is contextualizing its own performance of this in contrast to the cheap thrills and the search for ratings that generated this scenario in the first place. So it's an enactment and a recontextualization as a way to salvage something. Another way to think about this is not just a residue, but an attempt to save something. And in the book as a whole, we see the way that the physical form of the artifact has been inextricably entwined with its meaning productions. And the embedding of metaphors in the physical properties of the book that are mobilized to make this complex work. Now I'd like to just briefly comment on computational objects as delivery vehicles and what it means to create a different kind of artifact, and so to mobilize the physical properties of that artifact as metaphors as well. And here I'll be referencing the work of a red group at Xerox PARC comprised of those people. And I learned just a few days ago that in fact they've been all let go from PARC, so it's a brave experiment that isn't functioning, at least in a PARC context, any longer. But in their wonderful exhibit, The Future of Reading, these were some of the artifacts they displayed as delivery vehicles. This is the reading eye dog, and when a sheet of text is put on the stand before the dog, an optical scanner reads the text, and then a text-to-speech generation program produces voice so that the children gathered before the dog can have a story read for them. And it's interesting to think about how the form of this vehicle, delivery vehicle, offers metaphoric resources that can be mobilized in the content of works that would be written for this artifact. So among these differentials is human intelligence versus artificial intelligence, human parent versus a companion animal versus a robot reading without understanding, which is what the dog does, versus understanding without reading, which is what a young child would do. Voice production and written marks. Encoding and decoding as reading versus encoding and decoding as computer algorithms. All of these differentials are available there to be mobilized, and though the content written for this particular artifact is quite rudimentary, were this to be available to writers, I can imagine that they would think of all kinds of things to do with it. A related artifact is the speaker book, where pages are touch sensitive, and when you touch certain portions of the page, it activates sounds that come out of the book. Sometimes these are background sounds like wind whistling through trees or some kind of music. Sometimes they're particular vocalizations. So here the vocalization is located in the book and not only in the human reader. So the process of vocalization and subvocalization we all do as we transform the written mark to sound is here co-produced by the book as well as by the reader. And so it becomes a vocalization activity which is distributed and complex, which is complementary and synergistic in the effects, because the sounds don't just reproduce what's on the page but introduce another level of textual complexity. And of course it also evokes synesthesia, since the touch here is producing sound. The tilty table operates like a sort of periscope that you would put up and swivel around to look at part of a large textual landscape. And so the text is very large, and as you swivel the table, different parts of that textual landscape come into view. So if we think about the differentials being evoked here, it places the reader's bodily orientation in relation to the text, so that as you move your body, you move the text. This is in contrast to the Euclidean right angles that form the space in which the user is located. So it's creating a synergy between the body orientation of the reader and the table that's distinct from the space in which it's embedded. Text here cannot be conceptualized as a linear sequence, but an environment to be navigated. And because only part of the large textual landscape comes into existence at any one point, it emphasizes partial perspective over omniscient narration. It's very hard to imagine a text being written for this delivery vehicle which would use an omniscient viewpoint, because the very vehicle itself is defeating the possibility of omniscience, at least in any human viewer. There's omniscience in the computer, in that all the text is stored in the computer memory, but the activities of the reader are in contrast to that. So that the text enters human memory as spatialized partial information. The speeder reader is a very different kind of artifact. Here the text comes at you in a line at a time, as though you were driving down a highway on which textual lines are written. And of course this is literalized in the steering wheel and the accelerator you can use to accelerate the pace of your reading. And it conflates a number of differentials here: our desire to speed on the freeways and get where we're going as fast as possible, versus wanting to speed through a text as a form of information delivery, which is generally in contrast to our leisurely enjoyment of a complex literary text. So intensity, speed, maneuverability are all on the line here. Memory is being validated in this experience, as it is with the tilty table, but rather the speed of the experience. And so this is related to the kind of landscape, but almost in an opposite arena of metaphoric associations. The fluid reader is a kind of hypertext delivery vehicle, but very different than most of what has been shown. When you touch the active touch screen, the text bends down at that point and new text is inserted, which is of a digressive or explanatory nature compared to the text that was on the line. And so it introduces the idea of text as both scalable and layered, that it has many scales and you access these scales by bending the text. So the text is definitely not linear. The narrative on a plane is constantly supplemented by narrative in these fluid bendings where it appears as digression. So it automatically suggests the idea of nested stories and that perspective should be indexed not only to speaker but to scale. And then finally, the glyphoscope that has a device like a magnifying lens that you can swing around and put on different portions of the text, and as you do so, the text appears in a different guise. So on this page, for example, where you see an elegant Victorian-dressed lady, you swing over the magnifying glass and instead you see her skeleton. So again, here is the idea of interiority, but the metaphor is completely different. It's now not metaphor as fluid nested text, but text has multiple layers that can be revealed through the privileged perspective of the arm that's being swung over. So it does privilege perspective, but the perspective is done in a completely different way than it would normally be done in literary narration, for example, through a specific character. And then finally, I'd like to just speak briefly about programming language as a delivery vehicle and a new language that's being developed derived from Smalltalk called Squeak. And the idea of Squeak is to make a textual interface where each letter is an agent. And so all of the agents have senses. They know the letters that precede and follow them. They know what their position is. The letters have properties and can perform behaviors. So this is a slide of a Squeak screen where you can deform the text so it operates like a train following a train track and do all other kinds of behaviors with it. So it's programming language ideally suited to the idea of dynamic textuality. It also changes the smallest unit of meaning here from the morpheme, as linguists would have it, to the letter through the nature of the interface. And at the Tangible Media Lab at MIT, Hiroshi Ishii is developing with his students and graduate students and postdocs a variety of artifacts, including the genie bottle. And here we go to Rosemary Joyce's question, why are we so fascinated with glass and transparency? When you unstopper these bottles, a voice begins speaking as if it were a genie. And so the differentials here include the transparency of the glass, but the materiality of the voice, which are being evoked in contrast and comparison to each other. And then these telltales, which are sort of like Mr. Potato Head, and each of the components that children can put on the head have different narratives in them. So how they assemble the head determines what order their narrative is, and it's a device to sort of train children to what are socially intelligible narratives that have discrete parts where the body is bigger than the head and so forth. Also a wonderful way to talk about embodied narrative. And then finally, tangible viewpoints, where you can place a pawn, these again glass-like objects, on a sensor sheet, and as you do so, the perspective represented by that object, the character perspective, shows on the flat screen. So the differentials here would include the three-dimensional object tactily available to the user versus the flat screen behind it. Again, the idea of partial perspective and activation of that through kinesthetic motion, not through simply verbal decoding. And then finally, the possibility of mixed metaphors, since we're talking about metaphors, and we all have read in student papers expressions like, he was up a tree without a paddle. And of course, the problem with those as metaphors is that they change horses in mid-rail, and they provide us with incompatible visual pictures, creating a moment of incoherence and disruption. But my colleague at Bill Seaman is interested in how to use these moments of disruption productively. So he's created the hybrid invention generator, where he has different objects that you can marry to produce offspring. And the objects are invested with input functionality and output. You can specify what aspects of the input functionality and output you want to marry in these hybrid joinings. And you can also specify what percent of each object you want to appear in the offspring. So it could be 20, 80, or 40, 60, or whatever. So So here he's proposing to marry a computer and a fishing reel. But one of the more interesting ones is cell phone and light bulb, where the functionalities are being married to produce this object. Some of the objects that are created are monsters and have functionalities it would be difficult to see any use for, but some of them are very suggestive and in fact might serve as a stimulus to think about how to invent new kinds of objects. So in conclusion, Perry Hoberman mentioned in one of his comments that unusual interfaces appear only in art. But I'm not so sure that's correct. Bill Seaman, for example, thinks that this hybrid invention generator actually has practical uses for technological entrepreneurs. And I was struck by it this year's SIGGRAPH, the fact that in the emerging technology section, it seemed to be all about moving away from the GUI. And so I think that the kind of interfaces being imagined by the Xerox PARC people are not, whether or not those particular objects take off, are bound to enter our environment in increasing numbers. And these metaphors are about defamiliarizing even the most conventional interfaces as well. So Ann Tyler takes a very conventional interface, the book, and makes it perform new kinds of work through her physical manipulation of it as an artifact. We know there are dead as well as live metaphors, and any metaphor continued long enough loses its vitality. But work like this shows us the tremendous residual vitality there are in all kinds of objects that are available to do important work of signification. And obviously, these devices are alert to the social, emotional, and embodied implications of our technologies. We live in a material world, and the way these materialities are shaped, configured, and given functionalities has everything to do with their meaning in the immaterial world of thought. And of course, the immaterial world of thought also shapes these artifacts, and metaphors are the configurations that carry this cyclical traffic back and forth. Thank you.